We would like to thank Karen and Jake Abelevis for sponsoring this morning's Lachsel and Le'ilu Nishmas Shikspo, with parents Leah ben Abba and Leah Bas Avram, and Karen's brother Yeshua ben Shimon Dov, the Neshama should have an Aliyah, as well as to Tara and Steve Eben, who are sponsoring in loving memory of Steve's beloved father, Moshe ben Yitzchak Isaac Martin Eben, on the occasion of his Yortzeit. May the Neshamas have an Aliyah. We are in the middle of the 21st Mishnah of the 5th chapter of Pirkei Avos. We are talking about different stages of development. We're going to briefly recap the beginning of the Mishnah that we saw last week, which spoke about educational cognitive development, show you a brief excerpt from a video on Jean Piaget's research on cognitive development and how it relates to the Mishnah, but we'll keep that brief and then transition into mostly what we're going to speak about today are the more sociological / psychological, not cognitive in terms of intellectual, but more how people develop in terms of how they have responsibility and how they interact with the world around them. So focusing on the ages of 13, 18, and 20, which is the second part of the Mishnah. And then next week we'll go to the later parts of the developmental stages going from 30 to 100. So let's briefly recap at least the beginning to the age of 20 in our Mishnah. So if you look here in source A, Huaya Omer ben Chamesh Shanim Lemikra, 5 years old is when they used to or should start scripture. Ben Eser Lemishnah, 10 years old is when they started studying Mishnah. Ben Shloshesre Lemitzvos, in between that is when we start having an obligation to follow the mitzvos. Ben Chamesh Esrei LeTalmud, 15 is when they start Talmud. So in terms of education, you have 5 for Mikra, 10 for Mishnah, 15 for Talmud. And last week we spoke a little bit about the various differences between those. And then finally, Ben Shmona Esrei LeChuppah, 18 is when somebody was supposed to get married. And Ben Esrim Lirdof, 20 is when they are supposed to Lirdof. Lirdof literally means to pursue something. Unclear exactly what they are supposed to pursue. In the English here, they translated, which is actually a commentary because not everybody agrees that this is what it means. It means to pursue a livelihood. Okay, so we're going to explore that as well in the second half of today's shiur. So just to briefly show you a little bit about Piaget's theory, for those who took any psychology courses, I assume this made it, because this is a pretty popular and famous theory. So if you look here, I'm going to show you, this is probably where the ad came from, but this is a nice little infographic that that shows you the four parts that we're going to focus on briefly. And the four stages start here in the sensory motor stage, which is approximately from birth to age 2. Our mission does not discuss that. That is irrelevant to our mission. So you're not going to be teaching any text to children this age. This is when they're learning reflexes, they're focusing on senses, sucking their thumb, starting to move around. They're experiencing the world through senses and movement. Perhaps you'll start telling them Shema and get them used to it, to get them familiar with it for sure, but they're not doing any serious text-based cognitive learning at that point in time. Here's where our Mishnah really picks up, is in the second stage, which is pre-operational. This focuses from ages 2 to 7. Obviously, there's a big difference between a 2-year-old and a 7-year-old, but the point is that during this stage, they are their brains are starting to focus and figure out things within a general framework of pretend play. Well, let's look at the sum up statement on the bottom of it first, and then we'll see the examples. Children can think about things symbolically, so they can start looking at things in a symbolic way. So that's why pretend play is important, so they can pretend that they're somebody else that they're not. Object representation, that things can represent other things, and that's why also the alphabet on some level, when they're starting to learn it at this point, is symbolic of something else, so they can start getting these concepts. They are, if anybody knows any 2 to 7-year-olds, generally egocentric in the sense that they are mostly concerned about themselves, but that's also, there's some more recent research that pushes this a little bit in the sense that they still display empathy and can care for others as well. And I'm sure many of us have seen our children or grandchildren or nieces, nephews, friends, etc., who from the age of 2 to 7 they're not always egocentric. They're not always only concerned about themselves, but for the most part, they see the world through their own eyes, cognitively, not just morally, but just that's the way I can only see things through my own perspective, hard to take the perspective of others, and they're generally curious. So it's in this stage where we start to get some element of symbolic representations, and they can get the stories and the narrative and the like of Chumash, of Mikra, where they start the Mikra process. But it's still within the Mikra process where they transition into the concrete operation stage, which is in the left, bottom left here, the little yellow. It's where they begin to think logically about concrete events. So logic starts to play in. They can start classifying things into different categories, laws of conservation, which we're not going to get into now, but some pretty cool stuff. If you Google it, you'll see some cute videos of children who are pre-operational versus concrete operational, and how they measure things and see things within the world. To be able to induce, have inductive logic, and they could start seeing a view of others. Again, in our Mishnah, this is where they're basically solidifying all of their text-based Mikra, which is not very abstract. It's pretty classified. It's logical. You have to think, but it's pretty concrete. And that's why it's, you know, sort of concrete operations sort of fits nicely with that. And then from ages 12 and beyond, they transition to the formal operation stage, which is where they can start thinking a little bit more abstractly, like a scientist. They struggle with their identity, which is what we're going to focus on in the later part of our shiur. And they're they can become passionate about moral and social issues. You know, I'm sure many of us know some teenagers who are sort of very black and white in how they view the world, and very passionate about things, which is great. But it's a little bit of a different view than an adult view, because they sort of become impassioned. They start thinking abstractly. And it's like, wow, there's like bigger things in the world. There are things that I can think about or do that I haven't been able to even conceptualize until this point. And that's where in our Mishnahs, when they start, they're transitioning from the Mishnah, which is somewhat concrete operational from the previous stage. So it's classification, it's information. But now they're also, remember, by 15 is when they have enough Mikra, they have enough Mishnah, but it's not just about the content, was the argument I made last week. It's also about how their cognitive development goes and progresses, is that now they can start thinking abstractly, they can start thinking scientifically, and that's really what the Talmudic logic is. You can't do that too early. It's not just, here's the thesis statement, it's not just that you need information to go from Mikra to Mishnah to Talmud. You also need your brain to be able to do things that it hadn't been able to do before that previous stage. So the formal operations, which is the abstract scientific type of thinking, is required for the Talmudic analysis. It's not just logic, it's more than that. And that's why that happens a little bit later in the adolescence by 15. So the way I'm reading our Mishnah is that it's a combination of, you need to fill up with the information, because in terms of curricular decisions, there's a hierarchy, it's spiraled. You have to have the ABCs of Mikra before you get to the DEFs of Mishnah, before you get to the more abstract conceptualization and movement when it comes to the Talmud, and all of that maps out well onto how the cognitive development goes throughout from birth to the mid to late teenage years. So that's a little bit of a mapping out from last week. So what we want to transition now is from what I would say is the cognitive element to more of the identity, the social, the responsibility, not just how we think, but how we interact, how we view ourselves. And that is conceptualized in our Mishnah, I think, in the three other things that are going on. Let's reshare the screen for the Mishnah, which is the 13-year-old is when you are obligated in mitzvos, 18 is when you get married, and 20 is when you, let's just translate it loosely for now, when you pursue a livelihood. Okay, so these are growing up. What's interesting, let's start with 13 before we move into the other ones. That's going to be a discussion of adolescence in general. So what's interesting is that you can make the argument that once you're saying that a 13-year-old is completely obligated in the mitzvot, that there really is no stage of adolescence, the way we look at it. Right? So adolescence as a stage was popularized in the early 20th century by a psychologist by the name of G. Stanley Hall, who basically created this new stage that even before that wasn't really so well identified or contextualized, is that now we have this new stage of 13 to 20-year-olds or 13 to 18-year-olds who we call adolescents. Before that, it could be culturally there was no such thing as an adolescent in the sense that you were basically expected to, you know, grow up. Marriage was a little bit earlier. There was work in the fields and in various places that you would just have to go and do. And because of that, people didn't really think in terms of that age group so much. And now, after the Industrial Revolution, and there's different and school, and now there's really a need to relook at what's happening to these, let's call it, at 13 to 18-year-olds. Fast forwarding 100 or so years, and we look at it, and it's sort of pasht, right? You have an adolescence. Not only do you have adolescence, it's so simple, we take it for granted that, you know, everything, all of the stereotypes and all of the conceptualizations that we have of what it means to be a 13, 15, 17-year-old is just sort of like obvious to us that stage exists, and that 13 to 18-year-old is fundamentally different than an 18 to 25-year-old or from a 25 to 35-year-old. And because of that, only one second, but because of that, what it really generates, and this doesn't mean that's completely factually true, that a 15-year-old even 200 years ago was the same as a 25-year-old, but the point that we are, the point that we're making, though, is that what the question really becomes very strong, in, especially when contextualized within our modern understanding, is that how in the world do we look at this little 13-year-old and say, you are totally, fully treated as an adult from a Jewish perspective, right? You are, right, that 5-foot 13-year-old who just, you know, squeaked through his bar mitzvah parsha is no different from a Jewish law perspective, from the 95-year-old great-grandparent who was there watching and smiling and shepping nachas from it. So there's a question there, meaning that has to be understood. How do we give such responsibility? And is it a fair expectation, especially since what we know in terms of that they're not fully developed, both physically is obvious, but cognitively as well as morally. One of the interesting relatively recent findings from the neuroscientific literature, when they study the brain development through various different machines that can do this, which couldn't do this, 50 years ago, or even less than that, is that the basic consensus is that the front part of the brain, prefrontal cortex, which is generally looked at as the part of the brain that has responsible decision making, can plan, can control itself, sort of have self executive functioning, self control, doesn't fully develop until around the age of 25, which is sort of planting the seeds for what we're going to talk about in the second half of today, which is the emerging adulthood, which is another new stage. But the question, at least for adolescence, is how can you expect this 13-year-old, and everything we know about adolescence and risk-taking and difficult controlling themselves, you are fully 100% responsible, and we're going to treat you like an adult. Okay, so that's the question we're framing. We'll elaborate and hopefully develop some level of answer to that by the end of today. But first, we have a question. Elaine, yeah.
Yeah, so I think there are a couple of things at play. The time the Mishnah was written, we look at the brain development and just our development in general in context. So if people had to go out and work when they were in their teenage years, there were consequences for those actions, which now, when they're still in school, consequences aren't quite the same. And we can look at the other end when people are in college and in their 20s that prolong adolescence again because certain consequences are just not in play. So the context and the culture and the era in which you live, I think, also impacts. There's another thing then. So when the Mishnah was written, there seems to be a dissonance between what's expected of people in, or the 13-year-old, in the time of the Mishnah, and then today, the way we protract and we allow that adolescence, you know, a lot of leeway. So there's all of this stuff that's coming into play, I think.
Yeah, for sure. Again, I think you're you know, highlighting the point, is that there are definitely sociocultural elements to this discussion, and we talked about that on a different level when we spoke about the cognitive and educational decisions from last year. I mean, from last week we don't do the Mikra 5 to 10, Mishnah 10 to 15, 15 to 20 Talmud. We don't do that either, but we do 13. I mean, that's not changed, right? So the way we
impact people in different ways, that also shapes the brain. The brain just doesn't develop on it. So there are things that impact the shaping of the brain.
Right. So your point's a little bit more advanced, which is that it sort of goes in both directions. So that the expectations and the experiences will change the brain development. So yeah, I mean that's definitely true. I'm still curious. I mean, obviously, it's not a possible study, but you could probably do some level of historical research on this, you know, to see, in truth, what was it like being a 15-year-old during that. I mean, you probably can take from literature and find, you know, what was the description of a Shakespearean adolescent, and you know, before modern times, and there's probably still the ability to say it's not the same as an adult. So even with the changes, that I think there probably are straight up biological differences that are cross generational, cross cultural, cross historical eras. Some of that is probably adjustable. So meaning the exact age or parts of it, you know, and expectations and cultural might play a part, but it's hard to deny that there's a concept of a, you know, I think in the times of the Mishnah, the 13-year-old was not as developed as the adult. And still we said you're responsible. And it could be that that was a fair expectation. And again, for now, we're saying that's still the expectation. The question that's required is that a fair expectation, and even if the answer is no, it doesn't change the expectation. But it's at least something to think about and to consider and to struggle with. The 5 to 10 to 15 in terms of education is not a halacha. It's not something that's rooted. Even though last week we saw, it's not just logic. We have the second main point that we made last week was that it's not just rooted in logic and development. It's also rooted in allusions within psukim and verses that we say, oh, 5 learning mikra, it's related to this pasuk, and 10 mishnah, it's related to this pasuk, and you know, etc. But that's a little bit flexible and you know, not as set in stone. What we're going to see right now in source number 4 is that the 13 mitzvos is not just a suggestion. It's not just something that's, you know, that's just based on culture. It's based on strict halakhic expectations, and that's why it's not flexible. So if you look here in source number 4, so ben shlosh esrei lemitzvos, so we have, the Rashi has two sources for this. Excuse me. First is from a pasuk. Isho isha asher yasu mikol chatos adam, a man or a woman who do one of the sins and etc. have to bring sacrifices, meaning you are accountable for your actions once you are considered an ish or an isha. So now the question is, what's considered an ish or an isha? So Rashi says, ve'ein, continues, ve'eino kari ish achehu shloshes reis. You're not considered a man, and a woman would be 12, although some interesting discussions about that, but let's keep that for now. You're not considered a man until 13. Ukid eshkechan hasam v'yitchu. So how do I know that? So there's another pasuk. The pasuk says, v'yitchu shnei b'nei Yaakov, Shimon v'levi achei dinah. So the pasuk says that the two sons of Yaakov, Shimon and Levi, the brothers of Dinah, came, and that's when they destroyed Shechem, and they're called Ish there, and based on calculations, Va'az haya Levi ben Shloshes Reishana. So Levi at that time was 13. So basically, you know, you could figure out the calculations, it's a little complicated, but at the core of what we're saying is that you're responsible once you're called an Ish. How do we know what the age of Ish is? Well, we have a reference within the Pasuk related to Levi, who was called an Ish, and at that time he was 13, so it must be 13 is called an Ish. Okay? Not the strongest source for various reasons, because it's not even clear, you know, about Levi's chronology at that point, and what if he, and the sources, the Mefarshim deal with this, maybe it could be that a 10-year-old is also an Ish. It just happened to be that Levi was an Ish at 13, so it's not the strongest source, and others, and Rashi here quotes a second possibility, which is, I think, treated a little bit more concretely here, is that it's a Nusach Acher Ben Shalshes Rei Mitzos Demisha Hevi Shtei Saros Balachla Mitzos De Oraisa. This is a biblical concept. Right? So this is a strong idea. It's a halacha l'Moshe Mitzinai. So halacha l'Moshe Mitzinai means that it's a law that we have that dates back, very strong tradition, goes back all the way to Moshe. It's not necessarily explicit within the psukim, but we have a whole host of various different things that we treat as biblical, strong, very important concepts that we call halacha l'Moshe Mitzinai, which is a tradition that dates all the way back, even if there's not an exact textual source for it. So, you know, the color of tefillin and various other possibilities that aren't explicitly written in the psukim, but the tradition is a halacha l'Moshe Mitzinai. It's a law that dates back all the way to Moses at Sinai, and because of that, that's considered a biblical concept, and it's a shiur, it's a measurement, and a lot of shiurim that we have, the kezayis, the kebetza, for various things, are all considered halacha l'Moshe Mitzinai, and that's why this is a very important, strong concept that has no wiggle room. Right? This isn't a 5 learned Mishnah, learned Mikra, 10 learned Mishnah, 15 learned Gemara. This is a halacha l'Moshe Mitzinai that at 13, that is when you are considered a bar mitzvah. There's a little bit more details here. We're going to skip it, but you see that point explicitly in source number 5 here from the Rush. Vishasha'alta mi'ayin lanu de ben yud gimel son of yom echad hu bar onshin. How do I know that 13 you're already responsible for your actions? You'd be punished for your actions. About pachot mikain lo, but less than that, no. So he says it's halacha l'Moshe Mitzinai. V'hu b'chlal shi'urin chatzitzin u'mechitzin shein halacha l'Moshe Mitzinai. All these types of measurements, whether it's age or in terms of quantity, of various different things, they're all considered halacha l'Moshe Mitzinai. And there was a part of the oral tradition that we have that dates all the way back. Okay, so that's how we know 13. One other source that throws a little bit of a monkey wrench into this. And in order to do that, we're going to push and see the 18 and 20 before we go back to the 13. So we're still developing the 13. Still, it's a question on our part on some level, at least conceptually. We want to understand how can a 13-year-old be fully responsible. Okay, we understand it's a tradition, and if you say it's a tradition, maybe we can't ask. Maybe that's just what it is, and we just have to live with it. But at least to think about it critically, to, you know, practically, what are we expecting of a 13-year-old? So in order to fully answer that, we're going to extend our timeline a little bit. Let's look here at source number 16, is where we start looking at young adulthood, what later, we'll see if an article is called, in contemporary times, might be emerging adulthood. But the expectation here at 18, that's the next timeline in our Mishnah, is 18, you're getting married. Ben Shmon Asrei L'Chuppah. So look source number 6. Rashi gives an allusion to this as well. The Yurches Pamim Ksiv Adam Mibereshis Ad Kimi Ish Lukachazo. So within the context of the story of in Genesis of the creation of man, it uses the word Adam 18 times until it gets to the unification with Chava. So that's an allusion to the fact that you have 18 years in order to get married. So that's one explanation. Another explanation, Nosach Acher, the Omer Al Pirko Linase. The other explanation is that this is just the time to get married, right? So it's very fascinating. Again, I think it highlights the points from last week, is that you have within this Rashi or pseudo Rashi, whoever's writing this, is that you have the the allusion, the psukim, we're going to root it within some level of text, and then there's just the, you know, this is just when you get married, because you're 18, and now it's time to get married. So that it's pretty interesting to have both of those options. And then, what is lirdof? Lirdof b'mitzvos onshin. Yeah, so it's a little bit cryptic what that means, but the what it leads to here is a discussion of, maybe some of you have come across it, and this really makes the question somewhat stronger and less strong at the same time. So there's a Gemara we're about to see, and a few other sources that indicate that somebody isn't culpable for sins bein adam l'makom, between man and God, that are punishable in heaven, like kares, for example, until they're 20. Okay, so let's be clear here. 13, in this world, based in Sanhedrin, all the mitzvahs that have to do in this world, you are fully culpable at 13. There's a concept that we find in various places that when it comes to your culpability for in the eyes of God, you have a grace period until 20. So where does this come from? Where's the source of this? So look here in source number 7, the Gemara in Shabbos. It's a part of a larger discussion, which is pretty fascinating in terms of a dialogue between God and Yitzchak in terms of saving the Jewish people, not fully destroying them. So he's trying to figure out, he's trying to bargain with God to sort of say, what they're doing is not so bad. They don't have so many sins. It doesn't look as bad as you're making it out to be. And part of that bargaining in terms of not making it as bad as it, as it is, he says, "Va'od kama chatu? How much could they have sinned? Kama shnosav shalom? How long do people live? Shivim shana? 70 years? Okay, so that's 70 years. That's when you live." And we'll get to that when we talk about next week, when we get to the later stages in terms of understanding, when we talk about 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100. We have appellations for all of those, but the expectation, the life expectancy was basically 70 years. And we say that in Tehillim, right? It's 70 years. And if you're lucky, if you're strong, 80 years, which might be a hint for us next week when we get to 80 is considered a gvura. But here, Yitzchak's saying, most people live 70 years. So how much can you sin in 70 years? And not only that, dal esrin, take off 20 years, delo anshu alai. You're not punished for those first 20 years. It's like you get a free pass. Pashalu chamish, they only have 50 years. How much can somebody sin in 50 years? And then he keeps going. He says, you're sleeping half the time, and etc. But for our purposes, the expectation within this Gemara, this is a Gemara that says 20 years, no punishment. Look at Rashi, next part of this source 7. Dal Esther and Delo Anshuluhu, Shekain Matzinu Bedora Midbar. There's another reference to this in the generation of the desert. Shlo Ana Shakarish Baruch Hu Elam Asrim Shana V'mala. They were only punished from 20 and up. Those are the ones who died in the desert. The one who were less didn't. Why not? The 13-year-old? Should have died too. Should have been punished. No, only the 20-year-olds and up were punished. So Rashi says this isn't just made up in the Gemara. There's concepts behind this that date all the way back to the story in the desert. Rashi and Bereshis. Now this might be where you might be, if you've come across this idea or at least passed over it and haven't realized it. It's a Rashi and Bereshis. The first Rashi and Chayesara. Right. So my kids learned this in second grade. Third grade, whenever they learn Chayesara. So it says Chayesara was died when she was 127. But the pasuk doesn't say she died when she was 127. The pasuk says she died. How old was she died? She was 100 years, 20 years, 7 years. So why does it split it up? 100 and 20 and 7, and not just say 127. So Rashi teaches us that each one of these stages of 100 and 20 and 7 have their own function, their own message. So he says here, Lachach nichtav shana b'chol klal v'kal, says 100 years, 20 years, 7 years. Lomar lachach shekol echa nedr shashma. Each one is teaching us something different. Bas mea kebas esrim l'chait. When she was 100, it was like she was 20 when it comes to sin. What do you mean it's like 20 when you come to sin? Most people have racked up, 7 years of sin by the time they were 20, right? But the point here is that the assumption is that those don't count, right? So she's like, by the time she was 100, she was like she was 20, meaning she was clean from sin, because 20 is when you start getting, you have a clean slate. Mabas esrim lo chata, just like a 20-year-old hasn't, what, 20-year-old hasn't sinned? Yeah, because it doesn't count. Sharei eino bas onshin. Eino bas onshin. Not culpable. Af bas mea belochet. So, so too, when she was 100, like she didn't sin. Now take that line, sharei eino bas onshin, and contrast it to what we said before. Is that, look at the rush here. He says here, Lanu deben yud gimel shana v'yom echad hu bar onshin. 13, you're bar onshin. So what is it? Is it 13 or is it 20? When am I culpable? So we have here a clear, it's not just one source, not just one opinion, it's not just some random idea. You have a paper trail here of you're not culpable until you're 20. So what is it? What's the story here? What's going on? Okay, so if you look here now in source number 8. So the Chasam Sofer and others as well deal with this and say, how do we deal with these sources? On the one hand, we have 13 mitzvos responsible. It's hard to argue with that. And then all of a sudden you have this, 20 before that, no sin, doesn't count. So he says this as follows. 8, source number 8. Umashram zatash vihi lohi gia la esrim shana. So it's in the context of an answer he's giving to a response he's writing to somebody else. So that other person said, oh, 20, free pass. So he says, what you wrote about this free pass until 20. Nira daitcha she'enu bas onshin l'mayla zeh. So you seem to be saying that they're not culpable. So he says, zeh lo nimsa bishas. This is not found in the Gemara. Rak bidrushe agada. This is just an agadic statement. And just for clarification, we have two different concepts, parts of Gemara. Gemara has halachic concepts that discusses laws, what to do, how we practically look at things. And then there are agadic concepts. Agada is the narrative portions, sometimes referred to as legends, sometimes referred to as, it's nice ideas. Maybe in those who are familiar with the more, not Gemara terminology, but more Chumash terminology, you might look at it somewhat. It's not exactly the same, but think about it as pshat and drash, right? So pshat is what's there, what's written, what's clear, and it's the sort of operative. And then the drash is more embellished, more nice idea, not always something that's practical, not always something that you have to follow, but it's there. It's not Torah, it's Torah, but it's not operable. It's not you don't work on that. You don't do something practically based on that agada. So what the Chasam Sofer is saying is, yeah, you find all these sources. We just traced it. You have Rashi and Chumash. You have the Rashi in the Gemara about the fact that they weren't punished in the Midbar until 20. And you have it's an agada. It has to be an agada. It's creating a dialogue between Yitzchak and God. This isn't fact. This isn't happening. It didn't really physically happen in this world that makes it a halacha. So he says he basically just in one fell swoop pushes all of those to the side from a practical perspective. Those are all agada. Ukvar kasu, continuing. Kvar kasu mizachronim she'ein lismoch hazek klal. It's not operable. You can't rely on that. Quotes a Gemara and Tosos, beyond our scope for today, who said, So, putting all that Gemara and Tosos and complicated, convoluted part aside, for now he says, none of that matters, because the truth is, where I bolded this, avala emes mishenasu b'nei mitzvah b'shanim, once you become 13 or 12, v'simanim, as well as you've hit the puberty maturity on a physical level, mischayvim b'chol chiyuvei Torah, you are obligated in everything, but based in shelmala vishelamata, not just in this world, but also in the world above. God will also hold you culpable once you're 13. So putting this all together, what we basically have is, by 13 you're responsible. In this world, for sure, there's no moving away from that. A 13-year-old who goes and says, you know, within Torah law, we don't follow this exactly nowadays because we don't have a base in the Sanhedrin, etc. But a 13-year-old who has perfect, valid warning from two Edim who say, don't kill that person. And he says, you know, forget you, I'm killing him. And you follow all the laws and he kills him in front of the witnesses. That child, the 13-year-old, would be just like a 50-year-old, 75-year-old, etc., would get the death penalty and the whole nine yards. No difference for that 13-year-old. We have a trace of sources that seem to indicate that based in Shalmala, will have a little bit more leeway, give you till 20, take off the training wheels at 20. But from 13 to 20, he's a little bit more lenient. So even if you want to go that route, remember, that's not this world. It's irrelevant to this world. That's just how God wants to do things. I don't know how God does things, and I can't tell you how God does things. These sources are telling us from our tradition what we think God is telling us, but we don't really know. It's not operable either way. Nechsam Sofer says even that's not really true, and God's going to hold you culpable too at 13, even if there are no witnesses. There are no training. You are a full-fledged adult. So we have here this tension. And I can't tell you what's right or wrong. I look at it as a tension. And I think within the tension, you see what we experience as a tension. We do hold you as a 13-year-old fully capable and responsible. Nobody disagrees in this world. That's for sure. That's not up for debate. So you look at this 13-year-old. They're not fully developed. And we're saying you are responsible. So you can now look at that in two separate ways. You can say unfair. It's only 13, not fully developed. And I'm not denying there's some validity and truth to that. But the flip side to that is that by holding them responsible and saying we are treating you and giving you the, you want to call it respect, the expectation, we have high expectations for you. And that at 13, and hopefully in a good system, we are here to help and support and be loving and compassionate. And as you go through the struggle of life, because you know what? Even if your brain becomes fully developed at 25, it doesn't get that much easier. There's still struggle. There's still Yetzer Hara. There's still problems, right? So we will be there with you. We'll help you through that process. But we are going to treat you as an adult. There's something empowering about that, right? So I look at it as being a, you know, obviously a rite of passage, and now you're an adult. And maybe that's daunting. Maybe that's scary. I like having in the background this idea that God has a little bit more flexibility. And I think what you do see in those sources, even though it's not explicit, is even if it's just an agadata, so it's not operable in a halachic realm, it does give you the vision and the idea that like God's like winking at you a little bit. Like, I know this is hard. Like, I know you're not there yet. Like, I'm gonna give you some extra time. So whether or not we follow that practically or not is irrelevant. The point is that within the sources, you see it. So it's almost like you're pushing, you're holding responsible, you're maybe stretching a little bit, you know, the expectations a little bit above what they are, but not, hopefully not too far above. And then saying, you know, we're here to support you. We're here to help you. We're going to get you through this process. So that's how I conceptualize and put together all of these concepts. What then that leads us to now is, assuming you want to go with my approach, is that we now in contemporary times have pushed it a little bit farther for two reasons. Number one, right, so 18-year-olds generally, at least in our culture, are not getting married, right? 20, let's say 20 is lirdof to get a job. Most 20-year-olds, I don't know most, I guess it depends on culture and even within culture. You can't just say Americans. Right? It might depend on what type of, what, you know, are you going to college, not going to college. There's some 18-year-olds who are working and they're going to work for the rest of their lives. But 20 being here as going to work, or what you would say is now officially adulthood, right? You're not learning anymore. You're not in school. You're not in yeshiva. You gotta go do something. You gotta go. Lirdov, start pursuing something. So in contemporary times, now I'll show you this. I'm going to share my screen for a second to show you what the literature calls this. It's the stage, this new stage of adulthood. This wasn't always in existence. This was coined in the early 2000s as emerging adulthood by a psychologist by the name of Jeffrey Arnett. He has a interesting YouTube TED Talk that you can listen to. If you do, I there's parts of it that I have what to say back to it. We're not going to get into that at this point. But let's look at what he says, because there's, you know, parts of this is definitely true in terms of how the world is looking at this stage. I'm sorry, my screen's a little bit flopping all over the place here. Let's get this here. Okay, so this is what he says about emerging adulthood. This is from the APA, the American Psychological Association website, which summarizes the concept. Emerging adults, the in-between age. A new book makes the case for a phase of development between adolescence and adulthood. So gives you a little bit of background. Jeffrey Arnett, 1995, started looking at this, interviewed people between the ages of 18 and 29, various cities across the nation. And he basically, based on the interview, says that there's this in-between stage, right? So I'm not adolescent, right? I'm not a kid, but I'm also not an adult. So that sort of passage from adolescent to adult that was seamless and clear from that 18 to 20, you know, just like I'm there now. Now I'm responsible. I'm fully in it, right? There's no difference. You know, forget about sins, but just socially, culturally, responsibly, my family. That this is it. I'm 20. I'm all in. So he says that no, now there's this in between stage. And that's what he calls emerging adulthood. So what's part of emerging adulthood? Here, so you have five bullet points. Number one is age of identity exploration. Young people are deciding who they are and what they want out of work, school, and love. Age of instability. Post-high school years are marked by repeated residence changes. Young people either go to college, live with friends, or a romantic partner. For most, frequent moves end as families and careers are established in the 30s. Okay, so that what we in our mission are saying is supposed to happen at Lirdov. You know, you're 18, you're married. 20, you got a job. Is that happening at 20? Is now 30s, right? Age of self-focus. Freed of the parent and society-directed routine of school, young people try to decide what they want to do, where they want to go, and who they want to be with before those choices get limited by the constraints of marriage, children, and career. Age of feeling in between. Many emerging adults say they are taking responsibility for themselves, but still do not completely feel like an adult. Right, so I'm responsible, but I'm not fully adult. I don't. Where am I? I'm in between. I'm not really sure. Age of possibilities, final one. Optimism reigns. Most emerging adults believe they have a good chance of living better than their parents did. And even if their parents divorce, they believe they'll find a lifelong soulmate. Okay, so here's, again, it's a brief excerpt. There are books and articles, etc., written about this. But it's what's clear is that there's a whole group of people, whether it's everybody or not, you have a whole group of people who are now pushing off that marriage, work from early 20s, to now you got another 10 years to explore, to figure it out, to be free, to check things. What do you want to do? Wiggle room. Don't get married yet. Don't take that burden, that responsibility, because once you do, you're not going to be able to explore. You're not going to be able to figure yourself out. And now that's now the emerging adulthood phase.
This seems to be specifically for the elite Western class. In other words, if you're a working class and you have to go to work and you're, you know, as soon as you're out of high school and you're going to marry your high school sweet, I mean, it's a small percentage of the world population that can actually have this luxury.
Yep.
Of this protracted, emerging adulthood or protracted adolescence, if you will. Because
yep.
He said these are, they should have decided, you know, he assumed that they had done in adolescence and it's just going on.
Yeah, so that's definitely true. Here's another article.
But that doesn't fit with biology either, because by the time you're in the 30s, you're losing a lot of your chances biologically for reproduction and all the rest of it. So
Yeah, so there's definitely, listen, there's no, this is not an uncontroversial topic. Here's a sort of a counter article written a little bit more recently, but again, there's no debating that, you know, this concept is pretty rooted within the new framework of looking at it, at least within this culture, right? Within this you want to call it elite American college age type of culture. So this article, Social Historical Roots of the Concept of Emerging Adulthood and Its Impact on Early Adults, basically makes the stage, it makes the argument like you're saying, is that a lot of this is historical, a lot of it is cultural, doesn't apply, and Arnett would agree to that. And then part of the argument they're making in this article is that they don't really like the brain part. That's what this part over here is, the neurorealism in emerging adulthood, right? So this fact, quote unquote, of, I mean, it could be that it's, and it is a fact. The question is, what do you do with the fact that your brain isn't developed until 25, right? So what do you do with that fact? Right, so does that mean, okay, so now you're not culpable, now you're not responsible? And this has ramifications for policymakers, right? So what age do you say you can drink alcohol, you can vote, you can, you know, all these stages and ages that we put are related to this development. So do you say now, nope, we gotta move everything back a little bit because nope, you're not ready? Or, you know, do we have a little bit more wiggle room and a little bit, are we a little bit more patient, and do we less culpability, more leniencies for a 24-year-old because their brain's not fully developed? So what do you do with this information? So that's part of this, you know, this discussion and this debate. So this author is arguing that, you know, don't go from, you know, neuroimaging studies to policy. You got to take more things into consideration. And I would argue that from a, you know, again, religious side as well, we can make the same argument about the 13-year-old, right? So that's what we're basically saying. We know you're not fully neurally developed or biologically or physically developed and all that stuff, and we're still holding you, you know, responsible. So the difference between the responsibility and the biology, right? They don't necessarily go hand in hand, and that's the argument that this author makes now in this article, but not going to get into the nitty-gritty details of that at this moment. So what you do with emerging adulthood, and I'm sure everybody has their own opinions. You know, for those who didn't have the luxury of emerging adulthood, you know, I would say there's probably almost a backhandedness, nah, we didn't have to do that, right? And a not really buying into it. And I understand that. But just keep in mind, the whole point of this is that everything changes based on society and culture, and this stage, it does exist, right? Whether or not you want it to exist or you think that it should be different, there are people in their 20s who are just exploring, and that's what they're doing. From a religious perspective, from a Jewish perspective, let's say, what can we say about emerging adulthood? And again, I don't make claims to speak for all of Judaism or all of religion. You know, I'm just looking at our sources and trying to figure this out. Let's look at one last source here. Look at source number 9. So this is a Merkavas HaMishnah, and he's again talking in medieval times. But he writes as follows. Va'amar ben Esrim Lirdof. By 20, you're being lirdof. What does lirdof mean? Remember, we've seen so far translated as getting a job, basically being financially stable. So hinei ad esrim, hu ikar hachiyuv al ha'adam sheyilmad es beno Torah. Until 20, again, this is an interesting spin. Until 20, it's on the parent to take responsibility for their child, to teach them Torah, so mitzvos, and to teach them how to do mitzvos. Again, they're in the parents' household. Lasio isha, responsible for getting them married. Okay, so lots on the parents until the age of 20. And that statement's not so clear either from a Talmudic perspective. Would you say the same thing is true in the Gemara times? This is sort of unclear how that changes, but let's go with it for now. That until 20, you're basically, the parent is responsible, and you're in their sphere of influence. Amnam, kishia ben esrim, kvar yatsa ha'av michiyuvo. the father, or the mother, depending on what we're talking about here, we're talking about halachic terminology, so it's obligations of the father in terms of teaching and based on the Gemara and Kiddushin, etc. But for now, let's just go with the language here. By the time they're 20, the father is no longer responsible. I have nothing to do for you. Vihine hutzarech lishtad l'miatzma. Now you're on your own. You got to put in the effort on your own. V'lirdof achar asiyas hapulos atovos. And what does that mean? To do what's good. And so I like this definition because it's not just limited to go get a job. This is a broader definition. This is, yeah, at 13 you had mitzvos. Yeah, you were obligated. But you were still in this stage where the father, your parents were still had an influence on you. Even from 13 to 20, you were still involved with them and your father was still responsible for your maturing. Now you're 20 and you're free to go, not just financially. That's how we saw it until this point and how it was translated in the beginning of the Mishnah. Now you got to go get a job. That's not just part. You are morally responsible now to pursue what is good on your own. No parents looking over you anymore. This is your responsibility. V'alchein basin shalmala einu manishin es adam ad shia ben esrim shana. And he throws in what we saw before. So that's why based in heaven doesn't take hold you culpable till 20, because 13 to 20 is sort of training wheels. Again, your father, your parents still have an influence on you. You're working things out. 20, now you are responsible, not just financially, but morally, spiritually. It's all on you. So, obviously, this is less than the 13. So meaning 13, we don't have wiggle room. 13 is that's when you're responsible. Again, 20 in Shemayim, put aside for a second. But 13, that's halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai. You can't work around that age. So what's interesting is just like 5, 10, 15 in terms of the cognitive development was somewhat flexible. We don't have to follow those. It's not operable. So the same thing is true with 18 and 20. Right, so we didn't really talk that much about marriage. Maybe we should have. We could give a whole sort of mini lesson on that 18 marriage, but let's leave it for now. But 18 and 20, the marriage and this now lirdof, are not halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai. These aren't written in stone traditions that we can't, that you have to follow. You must get married by 18. You must be fully responsible at 20. And I think part of that is an acknowledgement that there's going to be cultural differences that will arise and different people will be, not everybody, even back in the day, not everybody was married at 18, right? So there, and not everybody at 20 was necessarily going out on their own. There was individual differences, presumably. So I think we have a little bit more room. And I think that instead of saying, you know, 18 married and done deal, no wiggle room, 20, you're on your own, and done, no wiggle room. I think we have to take into consideration various cultural changes and differences. We can't ignore those because, you know, usually when people try to go headstrong against reality of what's happening, they lose. Right? So you have to take into consideration what's going on. But there's also a counter message that I think is helpful and can be motivating for the 20-year-old explorer. And it's really an extension of the 13-year-old message. And that is, by 20, we have a broad general expectation that you are going to be more responsible now. You are going to live off on your own, whether that's in college. Okay, so you're coming home for Shabbos, fine. But you're moving on. You're going a little bit further. And your job now is to, broadly speaking, make sure you solidify that responsibility. Maybe as parents, the right answer is to extend from that hard stop at 20 that the Merkavas HaMishnah says. You know, parents, you're done. 20, they're on their own. So maybe we need to be a little bit more supportive for a few more years and a little bit more guidance and help, whether that's financially or whether that's emotionally or whether whatever, that we're still there, right? But same again. So the paradigm, the paradigm is the 13 to 20 extension that we spoke about. So 13, you're responsible, you're there.
fully responsible, 100%. With a little bit of wink in the background that, you know, you have till 20 as training wheels on some level to get your act together. So I think we use the same thing at 20. You're on your own, right? You're responsible. Go off into the real world. With a little bit of a wink in the background saying, you know, we still got you for a little bit longer if you need help, right? So the expectation is set. And I think that's an important point, is that I do think we should have an expectation for responsibility, and we should be training for independence and responsibility with a supportive network in the background to say, I'm here, I got you, I'm there for you as you do what for many is very scary, go out into the real world and try to find yourself, because it's a hard thing to do. So do it, try it, push, extend, get them out there, teach responsibility, but be there, supportive. I'm there if you need me. I'm here to talk. If I can, I'm here financially, if it's healthy and a good place. And I'm here to guide you morally, socially, financially. But you got to do it on your own. But I'm here. It's that tension. It's that wink. Do it. Responsibility. Expectation. But help in the background. That's my take. Feel free to agree, disagree. I'll take some questions, but just for if anybody has any comments, for next week we will transition to the later stages of development. We'll try to get from 30 to 100. So, you know, two shear I'm on 0 to 20, but one shear on the next 70 years. You know, it's not so much happens in that time frame, so I think we'll be okay. But we'll see you next week. If anybody has any questions, comments, or thoughts on this, feel free to pipe in, chime in.
Rabbi.
Yes, Laser.
When we have a bris for a boy, we say you should enter into the covenant of Torah, chuppah first, and then mitzvahs.
Well, masim tovim. So that's not really mitzvah. Right? It's an interesting question. You know, why do we wait for masim tovim till the end? So the question is whether or not you read that as chronologically, right?
Yeah, but that would be explaining 18 get married.
And 20 is sort of that responsibility. I mean, there's
responsible on your own.
You're on your own, right? So I could read that into the Merkabah submission a little bit. There is what to say, you know, that before. Before someone, not that you can't learn masim tovim or responsibility, or, you know, before you get married, or if you don't get married, you can. But there is some element of, you know, once you get married, you transform and change your outlook on how you interact and relate to another, and hopefully, if done right, can be a setting for masim tovim and sort of dynamic growth in a relationship, but we'll save that. If we did chuppah, which maybe we should go back and do a little bit more on chuppah in terms of the importance of that within a developmental framework, and the importance of that those intimate relations in relationships within the developmental framework, it's probably important. Maybe we'll allude to it next week, but. Okay. Any thoughts else? My mother is not allowed to talk. Okay. So we'll see you guys next week. As I close off the recording.